This half hour brought to you by NIL Game Changers, your ultimate destination for name, image, and likeness opportunities. Whether you're a business, an athlete, these are the people to turn to. Go to NILGameChangers.org to start your journey today. Jim Leland had quite a journey during the course of his life, eventually becoming the manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, the world championship manager of the Florida Marlins, and then with the Detroit Tigers bringing them to the World Series. Well, he made it to Cooperstown. He's in the Hall of Fame. John Parato covered him for years. John, welcome. It's so great to have you back from Cooperstown and a chance to talk about Jim. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be with you.
Jim Leland did a lot of great things over the course of his career. Pirates, Marlins, Tigers in particular. To you, what made him a special figure, especially in Pirates history?
Well, you know, when he came to Pittsburgh in 86, he was relatively unknown. He had managed in the Tigers farm system for 11 years, and then he was the White Sox third base coach under Tony La Russa for 4 years. And when he got the job, the Pittsburgh Press, the now defunct Pittsburgh Press, the headline was Jim Who. So he really came in as a very unknown person, and he took over a team that had lost 105 games in 1985. You'd had the Pittsburgh drug trials that September that totally overshadowed the end of the baseball season. You had the team almost move to Denver in 1985 into a public-private consortium of 13 businesses in Pittsburgh and institutions all combined to buy the team from the Galbraith family and keep it in Pittsburgh. So he walked into an unbelievably tough situation in 86, and by 88, the Pirates had come in, had a winning season and came in second place in the National League East to the Mets. And then 90, 91, and 92, they won the division. So basically, Leland came in and transformed, had a large part in transforming the Pirates from a laughingstock and one of the worst franchises in baseball to a winner. And, you know, he was beloved in Pittsburgh. He married a girl from Pittsburgh. He set roots in Pittsburgh, still has a home in Pittsburgh. And he just became a beloved figure. And, you know, I thought it was very poignant what he said yesterday in his speech. He said, his 11 years in Pittsburgh, it always felt like him and friends instead of him and fans.
Yeah, and not only that, to do what he did, and I go back to that era, I felt it wasn't just his ability to make lineups and make moves during the games, because I always felt he was an outstanding strategist. But I felt to get that job and to do that job, you had to have a certain personality to do that job. What kind of personality did Jim Leland bring to the table that made him different than other people?
You know, and he always brought this up. He grew up in Perrysburg, Ohio, up in the northwest corner of the state, right near Toledo, right outside of Toledo. And he was one of 11 brothers and sisters, so he had a lot of different personalities he dealt with growing up with that many siblings and his mother and father. And the one thing he was great is he could relate all kinds of people, white players, black players, Latin players. He could, he connected with his coaching staff. He connected with the front office. He connected with the bat boys, the trainers, the, you know, everybody, even the media, the guys that covered him. You know, he was good to us. I mean, he would tell us what was going on. And when he couldn't say something, he would be honest about it instead of making up a lie. And those kind of relationships, when you're honest with people, they go a long way. And Steve, I first met him in 86. My first year covering him was 88 as a full-time baseball writer. Right. And we still have a very good relationship 38 years later. So, I mean, that's just the kind of guy he is and the kind of loyalty he inspires from people who work for him.
But when you're managing the Pirates, you don't know what the front office is going to do or not do. And in the end, that team was broken up. And then he goes to the Marlins, wins there, and then to the Tigers. What does it tell us about Jim Leland, the manager, that he could excelled in other organizations and not just in Pittsburgh?
Oh, it says how adaptable he is. And, you know, like like you just pointed out, I mean, in Pittsburgh, unfortunately, at one time they had the third highest payroll in baseball in 1991. And they had, Ted Simmons came in as general manager. They brought in a new club president, and they said they had to take the payroll down from $57 million to $20 million. So that meant a lot of the good players either weren't tried to re-sign in free agency or were traded before they got to free agency. And Leland struggled with that, especially for the fact that they came oh so close to the World Series all 3 years in 90, 91, and 92 and fell short. But, like you said, he went to Florida. They brought in all kind of free agents, made all kind of trades, had basically a brand new team fitting a bunch of new pieces together, and he won the World Series the first year. And then in Detroit, you know, he goes in there, and they were awful. Yeah. And his first year, he goes to the World Series. So, you know, a lot of things. One, like you said, a great strategist, a great tactician. But two, just the way he connects with people, the way he set the culture, the way he made the clubhouse such a fun atmosphere to play in and work in, and just this ability to connect with people and get them to believe in themselves. And he did that time and time again with different players that really just blossomed under his under him being the manager. And you know, I really can't say enough about him. I've met a lot of people. I'm 60 years old, and I've met a lot of people in my life, but there are very, very few with Jim Leland's ability to communicate and to put someone at ease and make somebody feel welcome, and somebody who just, you just gravitate toward him. He just has that kind of personality.
What was it? You know, Barry Bonds is certainly, can be a difficult guy to deal with. How did Bonds feel about Jim Leland?
He loved Leland, you know, and everybody goes back to that day in 1991 in spring training when Leland and Bonds had their very public argument during a workout, and, you know, went on, you know, was shown all over the place, national TV, and, well, the internet wasn't around then, but if you go to YouTube, it's easy to find. And, you know, I think a lot of people thought because of that they hated each other. But the thing about Jim was, and this was great because, I mean, when I covered him, I wrote some things he didn't particularly like sometimes, and he would let me know about it. And the one thing about Jim, if he got mad at you, he didn't hold a grudge. I mean, like 15 minutes later, it was over. And I can say that from personal experience, and I know dozens and dozens of players who said the same thing. You know, if he got on you, there was a reason for it, and it was, he wanted, especially player-wise, he wanted to make them better. And sometimes to make a player better, you've got to get on them, and you've got to be tough with them. And I think they understood that, or they came to understand that over time and realized that he had their best interest at heart, and he really did care for them and love them. And it wasn't a case that he hated them. He just wanted them to be better people and better players.
Well, I mean look. In the end, if you can, like Bill O'Brien and Tom Brady had a famous one in Washington one day over Landover, and they both respect the heck out of each other. Doesn't mean, it just turns out life plays out in public for sports figures. It doesn't play out, you know, behind closed doors like it does in some other places. And obviously, Leland was a guy to be respected. What's your personal favorite story with all your dealings with him about Jim Leland?
The personal is, I covered the Pirates for paper in Beaver County, the Beaver County Times, for 21 years, and then the Times decided to cut back, and they weren't covering the Pirates anymore, so I was out of a job, and Bob Nutting hired me to cover the Pirates for his newspapers for a year, and because I wouldn't be a rah-rah cheerleader, that didn't last. It lasted one season and move on, and I was a free agent writer, and I became a freelancer, and I picked up a lot of gigs for different national publications. So it was my first year where I wasn't a Pirate beat guy for 22 years, and I mean, rightly or wrongly, it was my identity. I'd done it for so long, and I felt a little uncomfortable, and I was making the tour of camps throughout Florida, and one day I stopped in Lakeland where the Tigers train, and Jim and I talked after the workout, and we ended up sitting there chit-chatting for a little bit more, and he goes, there's something really bothering you, isn't there? And I said, yeah. And he goes, what? And I said, you know, and he'd known what happened in Pittsburgh with me, even though he's managing the Tigers. And he told me, he said, at the end, we get up, he shakes my hand, and really grasps it harder than normal and holds on to it for a minute. And try not to tear up here, but he said, you know, John, you're always welcome in the Tigers clubhouse, and I'm sure you're welcome in any other clubhouse in baseball, too. And at that point in time in my career, I needed to hear that. And that was 14 years ago, and it still sticks with me.
Wow. Wow. That's really impactful. There were other speeches yesterday, and obviously you're locked in on Jim Leland's. But did anybody else say anything that yesterday set back went, wow, something you didn't know before about the other inductees?
Not really. And I mean, they all were good and they all thanked everyone. And Joe Mauer was, you know, especially more poignant. Tom Wolf, they all were good. Adrian Beltre, Todd Helton. But I thought Joe Mauer explained it well as, you know, he had such a unique situation. He was the best college or the best high school quarterback in the country and the best high school baseball player in the country his senior year at Creighton Durham Hall in St. High School in St. Paul. So he was the local boy, but there were a lot of people that thought the Twins should draft somebody closer to being ready for the big leagues. They had number one pick that year, and they went with Joe Mauer. And Joe turned into a great player. He won three batting titles. And he said, he talked a little bit about the pressure of the potential pressure of being the hometown kid playing for the hometown team and how the Twins fans always supported him, always were behind him. And then he got choked up a little, which was understandable. And the largest portion of fans in the attendance yesterday were definitely Twins fans. I know the hotel I stayed in, it was just Twins fans. I mean, it was like all Twins fans, except there was one wedding. And other than that, I think every other guest except my wife and I were Twins fans from Minnesota. Whoa. So there was a really big throng of fans for Joe, and it was really cool to see. I mean, I dealt with him a few times over the years. I don't profess to know him real well, but always such a nice guy, always accommodating, always friendly, and it was really cool to see how many people. And that's not an easy trip to go from Minnesota to Cooperstown, and you know, there's no main highways near there. There's no major airports near Cooperstown, so if you want to go from Minneapolis, I should say, to Cooperstown, you really, really got to work at it to get there. And there were thousands and thousands of Minnesotans there yesterday.
Is part of that, though, John, Mauer played his entire career with Minnesota, which, as you and I both know, has become a rarity across the board. Do you think that was a factor in all this? A hometown hero, but never played anywhere else. I mean, Beltre played a bunch of places. I mean, the one season he played in Boston, my son and I went to a game, and he had a grand slam, won a game, but that was the only year he was in Boston.
Oh, yeah, I think it definitely has something to do with it, no doubt. And, you know, especially the hometown kid on top of it, playing his whole career with the Twins. And, you know, there were, you know, he had his ups and downs. You know, he won the three batting titles as a catcher, which no other catcher has ever done. And then he had the concussion problems, taking, you know, foul balls off the mask and things like that. He eventually moved to first base, and, you know, the concussions took their toll. He wasn't a star player his last few years in the big leagues. He was still a good player, but he had certainly declined. And, you know, and there were some people that thought, well, maybe he should get traded. Maybe they should move on from him. But the Twins stuck with him, and the fans stuck with him. And, you know, it really is just a really neat story. Yeah. And really, it was really fun. It almost had more of that feel of a high school or college atmosphere, where, hey, this is our guy, this is our school's guy, instead of, you know, professional team's guy. And that really stood out to me yesterday as far as the fans. I just thought it was really, really neat, Steve.
John, over the years, you know, a lot of things have changed. You know, maybe they've tried to add it, make it a little bit better. Sometimes they make a change, it's worse. You've been, I'm going to assume this is not the first Hall of Fame one you've been to. So in that guise, is it still the same, feel the same, or is there a little bit different compared to other years you've gone?
The one thing I noticed is I hadn't been there in 10 years, and there's a lot more media that covers it now. Now, also part of that may have been Adrian Beltre being Dominican, and there was a lot of press in the Dominican Republic there too that maybe ordinarily wouldn't have been there if, you know, for the American players. But yeah, the thing has kind of changed. It's, and like everything else, it, you know, it's become a little more corporate and a little more buttoned down and a little more staged than it was 10 years ago, or certainly the first time I went in 2001 when Bill Mazeroski was inducted with Dave Winfield and Kirby Puckett that year. But it's still a neat town. It really is. It's a village. It's the village of Cooperstown is the official name of the place. And it's, I don't know if you've ever been there, Steve, but it's a magical little place.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a hard-bitten guy. I've covered baseball 37 years, and, you know, I'm kind of a little cynical like most people would have done it this long. But you go there, and there's something special there. It really reminds me of, in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the town of Bedford Falls.
Yeah.
That's what it really reminds me of, except it's a real-life thing, and it's 70-some years after the movie was released.
I agree. I've been there twice. I've gone through the Hall of Fame a couple different times in my lifetime, and it's quaint and special. Finally, I want to ask you about Rob Manfred. Now, I know he's staying on through 29 or something like that, but he always comes off as stiff, whether it's interviews. I mean, there's just not the passion for the game. You just don't sense it. Is he like that at this as well? Is he just that stiff corporate figure, or is there a little more warmth to him that we didn't realize?
Yeah, I mean, he just doesn't resonate with fans, and I think you hit it perfectly, Steve. It just, he doesn't seem to have a passion for the game. It seems more like he's the CEO of the game, and his job is to make as much profits as he can make, like any other business. And we know, I mean, professional sports are indeed a business, but there's something different about professional sports, where there's a passion to it more. I mean, people don't root for U.S. Steel or IBM or Microsoft. I mean, people root for the Yankees and the Pirates and the Phillies and the California Angels and go right down the list. And, yeah, he comes, you know, even yesterday, he's from that neck of the woods. He grew up in Rome, New York, which is only even quite an hour from Cooperstown. And, of course, the MC, Brian Kenny from MLB Network, said, here are our local man from Rome, New York, Rob Manfred, and nobody booed him, but nobody either cheered him either. It was just kind of nothing. Yeah.
It's just I want my people around me to love the game. All right.
Yes.
And love the sport. I know he's an attorney. But you can't act the entire time like you're an attorney. This is sport. This is sports. I know it's a business, but it's a business that brings with it passion of the fans who are around it. You have to have a feel for that. And see, that's the part I don't think he has a feel for at all.
No, he just doesn't seem to enjoy. Whereas me or you, if we were in that position and we had a chance to be there on the dais at Cooperstown with 50-some Hall of Famers sitting behind us, it would be the thrill of a lifetime, but for him, it's almost like it's not even business as usual. It's almost like, I'm bothered to be here. I wish I could be somewhere other than here. And it's just mind blowing, Steve. I mean, it is.
I mean, John, you and I would have goosebumps, and he's like, okay, and you're Sandy Koufax. Who'd you pitch for? Okay.
Really.
always a pleasure, John. I love talking baseball with you. Appreciate you so much. Thanks for the time.
My pleasure, Steve. Anytime. Glad. Always good to speak with you, too.
John Parrotto does a great job of covering baseball, the Pirates. Always great to have him on the show. It's always a great conversation with him, and appreciate him very, very much. And this half hour brought to you by NIL Game Changers, your ultimate destination for name, image, and likeness opportunities. Business, athlete, they're the ones to turn to. Start your journey today at NILGameChangers.org. We'll shift gears and talk about the Sixers with Keith Pompey in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.